You don't know Flag. You don't know Flag.
Welcome to You Don't Know Flag, a podcast full of stories about retro gaming, retro computing, video games, arcade games, and technology from a guy who was there and still is. My name is Rob O'Hara, but for the next 30 minutes, you can call me Flack.
Episode 4. Console Copiers.
Hello and welcome to episode number 4 of You Don't Know Flack. Our regular listeners out there may have noticed that we skipped a release 2 weeks ago. That was actually for a couple of reasons. Number one is I suffered a fairly major server crash here at the house, which is where my website is hosted and where the files are hosted. And so the time I had set aside to record the latest podcast actually went to restoring server backups and running around and trying to get my server back online. So that was one reason. And then another reason was last weekend was OEGE, or the Oklahoma Electronic Games Expo, which is a first-time event that took place here in Oklahoma, and several of my friends from Digital Press and other online friends of mine came from multiple states to attend OEGE, and also we had an after-party here at my house, which consisted of playing games and trading games and talking about games and all that kind of good fun stuff. But unfortunately, that also took up a weekend, which was the other time that I was going to record this podcast. So unfortunately, the podcast didn't get recorded until right now. So that's why we're late, but we're here now. And this episode of You Don't Know Flack is going to be dedicated to console copiers. So we're going to talk about console copiers this week, those little devices that everybody's always interested in them. When people come to my game room, that's one of the things that I get a lot of questions about, because they're fairly unique pieces of hardware. Not a lot of people own them or know what they are, familiar with them. So that's what we're going to talk about this week, console copiers and my personal experience with console copiers. So let's go ahead and get started. The early days of video game consoles, by early days, I'm talking Atari 2600, Nintendo, Sega Master System, that era, late 70s, early 80s, mid 80s, didn't have to deal much with piracy. And especially they didn't have to deal with piracy at the level that home computers were dealing with. Software developers on home computers were constantly engaged in a cat and mouse battle with computer pirates who basically wanted software for free. Now, there were different motives for computer pirates, but some people broke copy protection just for the challenge of breaking it. Some people did it because they thought software prices were too high. But whatever the reason was, the end result was the same, is that software was copied and passed among friends instead of being purchased. That wasn't really a problem with the early video game consoles. One of the things I wanted to talk briefly about this week is the idea of security through obscurity. Security through obscurity, the best real-world example that I'm familiar with that kind of explains security through obscurity is the idea of hiding the key to your front door of your house under your welcome mat. So you have, when you lock your front door, you have security. And by hiding the key, you have obscured the method in which to open the front door. So that is security through obscurity. You have obscured the key from the regular person who walks up to the front door. The problem with security through obscurity is that it never works, because by its nature, the key to get into the front door, in our example, can be found, and eventually people will dedicate themselves to finding where that key is. And once the key is found, then the door is easy to open. The other problem with security through obscurity is it only takes one person to find the key. That person will tell all their friends where the key is, and now people can come and go into your house whenever they wish because the location of the key is no longer obscure in our example. So the early days of, well, there are several examples of security through obscurity not working. There's a great article called The 17 Mistakes Microsoft Made in the Xbox Security System. Go Google that title. Go look for 17 Mistakes Microsoft Made in the Xbox Security System. And there are some great examples in there of obscurity through security through obscurity. One of the examples is there was part of the encrypted code that Microsoft was using to basically secure the Xbox. And it was hidden really, really, really well. But eventually people, you know, figured out where that code was being stored. And that was one of the ways that the security for the original Xbox was unraveled. But anyway, there is a subset of security through obscurity when it comes to computers, and it is called security through minority. And that concept is similar, but the idea is that you have security because you have something that not many people have. In our key example for the front door of a house, let's say that you hang that key from the top of a 10-foot tall tree. And so now only people that have the ability to, you know, climb a tree per se, or maybe that are 10 feet tall that have stilts, can get to the key. So now you have security through minority. You've limited access based off of a very small select group of people that have a special tool. So in the early days of video game consoles, the main type of security that existed was security through minority, and that was the ability to dump cartridges or make cartridges to burn chips or EEPROMs. And that was something that not very many people had access to the equipment or the knowledge to be able to do. And in fact, it was such a small threat that companies, you know, video game console companies weren't worried about the average person dumping cartridges. The only security that went into that was region control, which is something that we still fight today, but they were more worried about other companies taking their programs and disassembling the code and figuring out, you know, maybe their programming secrets by looking at what they were doing. So that was the big concern. It wasn't, you know, they weren't worried about people actually copying cards. I don't know that ever entered their mind. You know, in the early days, there were flash carts that date all the way back to the Atari 2600. They're not flash carts like what you probably think of today, and obviously, they were more like, you know, EEPROM burners that you could take chips and put them into cartridges and do things like that. They were really expensive and somewhat complicated to use. So it wasn't like today where like a Game Boy or a DS flash cart where you could just, you know, download a game and copy it over and plug it in and have it work. Really my interest in console copiers doesn't come around until the mid-90s. And it wasn't through console copiers, but it was through emulators. And there was an emulator I remember called INES, which was the first, I don't know if it was technically the first Nintendo emulator for the PC, but it was the first one I'd ever seen. And, you know, so that there's this, there had been emulators around before, but not like PC, you know, totally software driven emulators that played console games. That was kind of a new idea. You know, there were, you know, I remember back on the Apple, like there were cards that you could buy for your PC that you could plug this card in and it would let you emulate the Apple hardware so that you could play at, you know, you could even copy Apple discs on your PC. So the concept of emulation wasn't necessarily brand new, but usually it involves some sort of hardware. So being able to, you know, just download this thing and play Nintendo games on your PC, that was a pretty novel idea. And, you know, it didn't work great. Now, I think I was running, let's see, this was probably back like with a, we're talking a 486-100, a DX4-100 here at this point. I seem to remember that I had just installed 95. So, you know, it was probably even before that. But, you know, regardless, that's around the era we're talking, late 94. You know, now that there's these emulators, there becomes this interest of how do you get ROMs to run on these emulators. ROMs being, you know, software disk images, disk dumps of cartridges. And there had to be a way to get these cartridges onto your PC so that you could play them with emulators. But I didn't really know how that was being done. In very late 94, in fact, New Year's Eve 1994, I attended HoHoCon, which was a hacker convention put on by thrown by a guy named Drunk. Can I say this? His name was Drunk Fuck, actually, and or Drunk Fucks, it's with an X, and it was co-hosted by the Cult of the Dead Cow. And I saw many very interesting things at HoHoCon. You know, I've always been interested in hacking and, you know, computer hacking and figuring out how things work and computer security. But when I went to HoHoCon, I instantly realized that basically everybody there was smarter than me. Everybody at HoHoCon was doing just these insane projects. You know, we watched, you know, it was kind of, it was pretty early, I guess, for cell phones. And there was a guy there that was showing how to grab, you know, security ESN numbers from cell phones and reprogram cell phones on the fly, which is, kind of a neat trick. And there was all different kinds of like technical presentations and people just showing off, you know, weird things that they'd built or whatever. And one of the things I remember seeing was a Super Nintendo that was hooked up to a projector. And these guys, in between speeches, were playing games on it. But I noticed that the games weren't in cartridges. The games were being loaded off of a floppy disk. And so I never talked to the guys that had the copier, but I sat there and just watched them, you know, watched what was going on. And I kind of gathered that this was, you know, what I'd heard referred to as a console copier. They were also called backup devices, I think. But console copier is the verbiage that stuck. But the idea of a console copier is twofold. It serves two main functions as far as cartridges are concerned. Number one, a console copier is a external device that plugs into a console. They're all cartridge-based consoles. So this device plugs into the console, and then you can plug a cartridge into the device. So the device sits between, you know, the console itself and the cartridge, where the cartridge plugs in. And then the device also, the majority of these devices also include, they include some sort of media loading system. The early ones were all floppy disk based, but later on we'll see some that have zip drives in them, and then eventually CD-ROM drives. But the idea of this device is twofold. The first idea is that you can put a cartridge into it and dump the contents of this cartridge onto some, you know, form of storage media. I'm just going to say floppy disk for right now. So you could take a Super Nintendo game, plug it into the top of this, and save that game onto a floppy disk. If the game was too big to fit on a floppy disk, then it would actually span it across multiple disks. So That's the first thing. So, you know, all of a sudden it becomes clear, oh, that's how they're, you know, getting these games that they're using for emulators. But the other thing that you can do with a console copier is you can remove that cartridge, you can load that game back into the console copier, and you can play it on a real console. And that was probably just as interesting to me at the time because, you know, like I said, emulation on my 486 was not very good. But emulation, I mean, you wouldn't even really call it emulation. You could play these games on a real console and they ran at real speed. It was just like, you know, it was the same code. So it was just like you were inserting a cartridge, except for you were loading it, you know, off a diskette. So, you know, now these days on the internet, I'm sure you could go out and type in, you know, find a torrent or whatever for a complete collection of, let's say, Atari games. In fact, I got one a few years back, and I want to say zipped up, it was about 3 meg. So, you know, you click this button, you click a link somewhere, and you download every Atari 2600 game that's ever been commercially released, and you can download it in about 45 seconds. But back in the BBS days, things didn't work that way. You know, you were in the midst of these consoles' lifespans, and they were constantly releasing games, and so each game would be its own release. You're talking about BBS, you know, dial-up times, maybe 2400 baud during this time, maybe 9600, but for the most part, you know, pretty slow speed. So, and of course, console games aren't huge, but you're still dealing at one game at a time. But, you know, I'm seeing these files being traded and back and forth, the ROMs from cartridges. And so this, you know, seems pretty interesting to me. I get home from HoHoCon, and now it's the spring of 1995, and I've decided that I want to own one of these console copiers. I think this thing is really cool. And the only way to get one is, you know, obviously to find someone who's selling them. It's not like you can, you know, go to, you know, Walmart or Best Buy or something and pick one of these things up. I mean, console copiers are pretty much being made like, as I described, they're being made and sold in the back alleys of Hong Kong. And, you know, as a kid and growing up in the Midwest, in the middle of Oklahoma, I did not have any contacts to the back alleys of Hong Kong, you know. So I did eventually find a BBS, and I found someone who knew someone who had an email address. And, I mean, this is the really, for me, you know, one of the first things I ever did on, you know, the internet, or I should say on the World Wide Web. I got online. I started using the internet in the fall of 94, but I really didn't experience the web until like March of 1995. And so, you know, I get this email address for a guy who went by, well, Anthrox, who was associated with Fairlight. And I find out they're selling Super Nintendo console copiers. So I emailed him and found out that they had one left. They told me that they were getting out of the console copier business, but they had one left, and if I wanted it, it was mine. And so what I had to do was get a money order for $300 and mail it to them, and I could have this console copier. Now, if you think about this at the time, you know, in 1995, I'm like 22, you know, I'm 21. I haven't even turned 22 yet. So I'm 21 years old. I'm working at Best Buy. $300 is a lot of money, you know, for something that's going to allow you to play free, you know, video games. And on top of that, I'm going to get a money order and mail it to somebody somewhere who's going to send me something eventually that's going to come from Hong Kong. I mean, so this has bad idea written all over it, you know, but I was so desperate to get one of these. That's what I did, you know, and I had actually looked around for different models of console copier, and the Super Nintendo files that I had seen being traded on BBSs all had the file extension of SWC. SWC stood for Super Wild Card, which was the copier that I had ordered, was a Super Wild Card DX. So, you know, I thought, well, that must be a really good one. And so I did go ahead and order it. And I mean, it took a long time to get here. I mean, it took long enough that I was nervous anyway about, you know, you're ordering this thing that's probably illegal. And you're sending this large amount of money to somebody who you know as Anthrox, you know. So, like I said, you know, everything inside me said that this is probably a bad idea. But the console copier did arrive, and it worked exactly as advertised. I mean, I fell in love with it immediately. Hooked it up to my Super Nintendo, and, you know, for the first time, I could, you know, take my cartridges and dump them to floppy disks and play them off of floppy, which, you know, let's be honest, that part of it is not, I mean, that's probably the least exciting thing that one would do with a console copier. Why would you want to play games that you already own off of floppy when they're exactly the same as playing them off a cartridge, except for it takes longer to load? But once you had those things on floppy, you could do things with them. You could, you know, go look at the code. You could actually, the Super Wild Card had things where you could search code and you could look for the variables where things were being held, like however many, you know, min you had, and you could edit those variables and actually edit the gameplay. And then there was, like I said, since this was the same format that people were using on emulators, you could, you know, get on BBSs or soon thereafter on websites and download any, you know, Super Nintendo game I wanted. I could download those, put those on a floppy disk, and then put them directly into my Super Wild Card and play them on a, you know, real Super Nintendo. And that's, for me, you know, I'm not, I'm probably more pro emulation than I am against emulation. I don't mind emulation. I know people have hang-ups over emulators and stuff, and I realize that it's not the same as playing the real thing, but it doesn't bother me as much as it bothers some people. But, you know, playing these ROMs on a real console, on a console copier, it is indistinguishable from the real thing. It, you know, it is the real thing. And so I enjoy that more than I enjoy emulation. Like I said, I'm not anti-emulator. I know some people, you know, are really against the whole thing. But anyway, so I started, you know, getting on these websites and stuff. And if there were games that I couldn't, you know, find online to download or find on a BBS, or there was a game that someone was wanting, I would go rent the game. And, you know, rent the game and get it home and dump it to disk and, you know, then return it. And then I could take that and upload it and trade it for, you know, maybe other games that I wanted or something. But that's how I got started with console copiers, was with the Super Nintendo Super Wild Card. And this is like I said, this is 95 or whatever. And, you know, after the Super Nintendo, the next thing I got, I believe, was the Sony PlayStation. And of course, you know, once you get to CDs, there's no need for console copiers anymore. That's when you start getting into mod chips or other, you know, types of devices. But it wasn't until I didn't get a Nintendo 64 until probably, 98 or 99. I actually got the Nintendo 64 that I got, came with Pod Racer. It was the Pod Racer, you know, package. So I got the Nintendo 64 in the Pod Racer, package. And I remembered the Super Nintendo console copiers. And so I started looking around for Nintendo 64 console copiers. I thought, well, you know, it's cartridges, so maybe there are copiers out there. And there were. In fact, there were three major Nintendo 64 copiers. And the first one, it wasn't the first one, but the first one that I found was one called the Z64. It's also called the Mr. Backup. But the Z, it's easy to remember because the Z in Z64 stands for zip. And the Z64 actually uses zip disks to store its games on. So Other than, you know, it being a larger type media, which makes sense because Nintendo 64 games were obviously bigger than Super Nintendo games. But you could, you know, do the exact same thing. Put cartridges in, dump them to zip disks, and then play them directly off these zip disks. And you could probably store anywhere from 4 to 8 games on a zip disk. And then you could do, like on the Super Nintendo, you could get those ROMs, you know, off the internet and then copy them to zip disks and play them on the real hardware, you know. And so I got back into it a little bit with the Z64. There's the V64, which is probably the most famous or infamous copier for the Nintendo 64, made by Bung. And there's also a V64 Junior, which was kind of a cross between a console copier and a flash device. And then the other one was called a CD64, which by its name, you can probably guess, has a CD-ROM drive instead of, you know, using zip disk. The V64 also has a CD-ROM drive. And so, you know, I actually own all three of those now. I own a V64, a Z64, and a CD64. And, you know, I like console copiers for more than just blatant piracy. You know, I mean, that's what a lot of people did. They had them and that's all they did with them. But for me, it was more about being able to dump the code, you know, because as someone who has always enjoyed, you know, programming and disassembling things, especially software, it's always been fun to me to be able to take this cartridge because, you know, a cartridge is like this kind of mysterious thing. Like, you know, there's a game in there, but, you know, how do you get the game out? How do you get that information out and put it on your computer? And, you know, with a console copier, you can do that. You can take this cartridge and dump it and, you know, see its guts and go through this, you know, code. And I mean, don't get me wrong. A lot of it, you know, doesn't even make sense to me, but just, you know, the ability to look through that stuff, is kind of interesting. And once you get to the CD based consoles, they start losing that. I mean, when you have a device, you know, you can't write, to CDs with these things like the CD64. Now, some of them do have parallel ports, which you could connect these to your computer and dump things this way. Honestly, I've never got that to work. I mean, I know it can be done and I've seen it done, but it just doesn't seem worth the hassle. And obviously, as you know, computers get newer and parallel ports are slowly becoming a thing of the past. They kind of lose that feature. So whenever you look at these devices, the way they're set up, you know, they have really easy to navigate menu systems and they're made to put in a CD and you can put in a CD of, you know, 100 games on it or whatever. You know, the intention becomes more clear with these that it's just kind of obvious that these are made to play copied games and they're not made to, you know, disassemble stuff or dump cartridge code or anything like that. So the CD ones kind of lost a little bit with me. Now, there was one other copier that I had originally, which was called a Multi-Game Hunter, an MGH, which is not my favorite copier. It was the selling point of the Multi-Game Hunter is each of these console copiers has a way that they connect to the console, the host console, like the Super Wild Card plugs into the top, you know, the cartridge port of where the Super Nintendo goes. And so obviously that connector looks like a Super Nintendo cartridge. And the Multi-Game Hunter has interchangeable bases, if you will, that you can interchange these. And so it can plug into either a Super Nintendo or a Sega Genesis. And so mine, I've just have it permanently set up as part of my Genesis setup. And it does, you know, its job. It dumps carts, and I've actually dumped a few prototype carts with it. And, you know, it works well. The biggest problem, you know, it's kind of flaky is one of the problems, is it's this really big and large, and the way it plugs into a console is kind of weird. And, you know, a lot of these use kind of funky or proprietary floppy drives, and so, you know, that's another thing that I'm always worried about. You know, if that thing goes out, you're going to have to find a vintage floppy 3.5-inch drive to replace, you know. So The multi-game hunter is okay, and it does some cool stuff, but and multi-game hunters, when they originally came out, were sold for a little over $500, which is crazy if you think about it. But, you know, then again, you know, the ability, it was like two copiers in one package. So, you know, I guess it's worth it for those type of people. I didn't pay anywhere near that. I bought a boxed one, probably around 2000, I mean the year, not the price. Around the year 2000, and I probably paid maybe $150 for it, because it was boxed. You know, a loose one will probably sell for around $100. And over the years, I've probably collected another half a dozen console copiers. You know, I set myself up with, like, the Super Wild Card is by far my favorite for the Super Nintendo. So I have picked up some from other companies like the Pro Fighter and the UFO, and I own those. But, you know, the Super Wild Card is my favorite, and that's the one that stays hooked up all the time. So I've bought, like I said, probably five or six more over the years, just, you know, to have them for the collection, just because I think they're interesting. But I don't, you know, I don't use them on a regular basis. And so, you know, to kind of wrap up the conversation about console copiers, people ask me, you know, well, what happened to console copiers? Like, where did they go? And there are really, you know, a couple of different answers to that. The first one is obviously for, you know, home gaming systems, cartridge-based systems went away. I mean, the Nintendo 64 with that, when it, you know, when it was phased out, everything went CD-based. And so for CDs, now, you know, there are mod chips, and that's kind of, so mod chips are kind of the spiritual, I guess, successor to console copiers in a way. I mean, really, you know, mod chips are more just about playing pirated games. They're not about dumping cartridges per se, or, you know, dumping CDs. So, but you have mod chips. And then the other thing that happened with console copiers was, Nintendo sued Bung Enterprises, which was the maker of the V64. And there had been, you know, lots of, like I said, lots of back and forth lawsuits and threats between game companies and, you know, the makers of these things. Bung, you know, Bung actually sold the V64 and the V64 Junior as cheap dev systems. And there were a lot of people that were using those because, you know, Nintendo, to get a development Nintendo 64 system was so expensive and difficult to, you know, get, that you could, you know, they sold these console copiers as saying, hey, you can develop your own code and test it on a real Nintendo 64, you know. But Nintendo didn't buy that, and so they filed a lawsuit against Bung Enterprises, and they won. And as part of the injunction, Bung Enterprises was forced to close their doors and to stop selling anything related to circumventing Nintendo's copy protection. They also won about $7 million in damages against Bung Enterprises. So that pretty much forced Bung Enterprises out of business. So you have, number one, the consoles, you know, changing from cartridge to CDs. Number two, you have this lawsuit against Bung, which pretty much scares everybody else out of business as well. And then the third thing is we see this advance in technology, and things basically move to flash-based systems. So as far as, if you look at, you know, all the handheld gaming things, like Game Boy Advanced, Nintendo DS, you know, they all move to flash-based cartridge systems, and that's, you know, kind of the route that things took now. And again, you know, those things, they're not really the same as console copiers, because console copiers had that whole thing that allowed you to, you know, dump games and look at code and alter code and get the sprites out of games and all those sort of little fun features. And, you know, flash carts and mod chips and stuff, they don't really offer those same things. I mean, basically, they just let you, you know, play copied games, which I mean, if that's what you want to do, then, you know, they work well, but they don't give you all those other kind of neat features that give you a little bit of, you know, kind of felt like you were doing something neat back then, you know, by, you know, disassembling stuff, and you don't really get the same feeling with that. But anyway, but that's kind of, I guess that's my basic history with console copiers. You know, I've had them for, gosh, I've been playing with them since 95 now. I saw that first one in 94. And I think that I bought one last year. I don't remember. I think it might have been one of the UFO copiers. So I still play around with them and stuff. They're kind of neat. And they're always they always get a lot of questions when people come over to the game room and see these, you know, big giant things sitting on top of consoles that they don't recognize. So, but anyway, that's console copiers. So with that, I think we're going to go ahead and cut off episode 4 here. Before episode 5 launches, I think that I'm going to close the doors on tech.robohara.com. It's kind of just a duplication of effort, really. And so I think what I'm going to do is close that. I'm going to roll the podcast over to, I'm going to relocate it to robohara.com. And, you know, not, basically nothing will change. I'm just going to combine that subdomain with the regular domain. So I would expect to see that before the release of episode number 5. And speaking of episode number 5, I don't know what it's going to be about, but I can tell you two different things. Number one, I may be talking about game conventions. You know, I just mentioned that we just had OEGE. And from what I hear, there will be a OVGE, which is the Oklahoma Video Game Expo, which started in 2003, and we had them for 4 years in a row. Last year, they took a year off, but I think from what I'm hearing now, there will be an OVGE sometime this summer, maybe this August. So I may be talking about video game conventions. I've been to several different ones. The OVGEs I've been to... a couple, you know, some computer ones, and I've also been to CGE last year. So I may talk about that. I also may be talking about Photon, which is not necessarily game related. So if you don't want to hear about Photon, be sure and email me, and I won't talk about Photon. But there's a kind of an interesting thing going on. Photon was a laser tag. It was the first big laser tag arena back in the 80s. And they went out of business, and there's a guy here in Oklahoma who is building a laser tag, and now he has run into financial trouble. It was set to open this week, and he's just sent out word that it's not going to be able to open due to funds, but next weekend he's going to open it for everybody to come and see, and they are going to actually try to have some games. So I will be going to that. That's going to be in Tulsa next weekend, so... you know, I'll have Photon on the mind, so I may end up talking about that, who knows. But anyway, you know, I'm trying to keep these at around 30 minutes, and I've already, you know, once again, I've gone over, but anyway, I'm going to wrap up episode 4. So there we go. We talked about console copiers. Next week, or in 2 weeks, we'll be talking about something else. So I hope you tune in. My email address is flack@robohara.com. So if you want to write to me about the show, or if you have any requests for things to talk about, drop me a line. And with that, I think I'm out of here. So I will see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening. And boy, I was going to think of something witty to say. You waited this whole, you've been listening to this for 35 minutes, and I should have something to say. I was going to say, I'll say, have a flaky day. All right, so have a flaky day, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.